Most of England is expected to be placed into the two toughest tiers of coronavirus restrictions next Wednesday when the national lockdown ends. A formal announcement, as I mentioned before, on which area will face which tier and which set of rules will be made by the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, at some point today. We don't know the time, as I said before, but the hope is that with the restrictions that we've been under and with people playing their part and the job that the people of Liverpool and Merseyside have done, getting tested, number of cases will have come down enough in our area to mean that we can be placed in the lower level tier. But of course, we just have to wait to find out. Liverpool Mayor Joe Anderson has been talking to the BBC earlier. This is what he said.
It's now over 6 weeks since we've been in tier three. We've managed with mass testing, which this is the third week we've been using mass testing with the armed forces here in the city, we've been able to bring the virus back under control again. And so, you know, our ask of government is now to consider the data and the information. In fact, if we take out the asymptomatic tests that's been done with the mass testing here in Liverpool, if we take out those asymptomatic positives, then Liverpool is actually in tier one territory, not tier two. We're actually as low as 72.
Interesting point, but how have the past few weeks been for case numbers across Merseyside, and what could the next few months be like with the advances that have been made around vaccines? There seem to be, it's they're like buses, aren't they? You know, get one for ages, then there's three or four on the horizon. Well, Dr. Angela Obasi is the senior clinical lecturer at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. She's with us on the line now. Dr. Angela, good to have you with us again.
Lovely to be here.
A lot can happen in 2 weeks since you and I last had a chat. How do you think things are looking now in comparison to that chat we had 2 weeks ago?
So much better. I mean, even, you know, we've now got, last time we spoke, it was Pfizer just released their information. Today, we've got AstraZeneca. There are over 300 vaccines in development. But the Pfizer and the AstraZeneca vaccines are using two different strategies. So not only do we have a couple of different vaccines, we've got a couple of different proven pathways for effectiveness. Both of them are better than the flu vaccine that we routinely queue up for and use every winter. So, you know, I feel really, really optimistic.
And of course, the Oxford vaccine that was announced earlier this week, and it was strange, but we were having a conversation about this, you know, the way that our minds work. And when they said this one is 70%, and there was a part of us that went, oh, is it only 70%? But when you combine it with another dose, a smaller dose than a larger dose, that then brings it up to 90%. It can be stored in a regular fridge rather than these, you know, super coolant fridges. And it's going to be a hell of a lot cheaper. I mean, that sounds like a real winner.
As usual, you've completely nailed it on the head. I think, and the AstraZeneca one is the one that we've been working on. My colleague Daniela at LSTM, Daniela Ferreira, has been working on, and it's a real world vaccine. This is a vaccine that can be shipped, can reach resource pool settings where, you know, you don't have the cold chain facilities that the Pfizer vaccine would require. I think that question about why giving a smaller dose and then the second larger dose makes a difference is a fascinating research question. And I think, you know, all eyes will be on that arm of the study to understand why that is, whether it has an impact on the duration of protection provided by that vaccine. There's just so many new questions coming out. And the next vaccine that is proven to be effective will have its own set of questions attending it. But these are all good problems, right? These are all good, good problems. I'm just delighted. It's very, very, it's wonderful.
And I immediately thought of the work that's been going on behind the scenes at your place, University of Liverpool, and people of this area who were asked to step forward. Can you please come and be part of a trial? Can you please come? And people turned up. And this is the legacy of that now, what we're seeing at the moment.
I think I said it last time, you know, Liverpool punches above its weight. Joe Anderson has just been on talking about testing. This is a contribution to the global effort, really, not just the UK effort, that people of Liverpool have made. And the same is true of the vaccine. I think when we spoke last time, Tom Wingfield had made the point that, you know, Liverpool had recruited more participants in the older demographic than anywhere else at the time that he was making that presentation, and that's, you know, it's the spirit with which people in Liverpool have just come forward. It just makes you proud, doesn't it?
Really? It does make you very proud. What's it like for you being part of this field and working in this field? I know for me, and I'm sure many of our listeners, ordinary members of the public, when we found out about the vaccines that were coming forward, you know, we were cock-a-hoo. We were punching the air with this. For somebody who works within that and knows a hell of a lot more than we do about it, what's it like for you and your colleagues when those announcements come through?
So I'm not a vaccine expert. You know, Daniela, Daniela Ferreira is leading that effort in LSTM. But I am an epidemiologist, so I do think about, you know, how vaccines may have impact on a population level. Yeah. And for me, there is real delight. I mean, if you think it took 9 years to get the measles vaccine, it took 20 years to get the polio vaccine. And here we are with two really strong candidate, you know, effective vaccines within a year. So my first reaction is shock and awe at how much has been achieved. And then just this tremendous feeling of, yeah, pride, really, in the way that as a community of scientists, globally, we have come together to get this done. And as I say, I've not been part of the vaccine effort, but it does make me proud to be a scientist. And there was an article in The Economist last week making this point about the global nature of this effort, where there's a German company led by a Turkish immigrant was collaborating with an American company led by a German immigrant to pull a candidate vaccine together. It's
amazing. Greater good, isn't it? You know, people are people, and it's for the greater good. We all have families, we all have fears, we all have hopes, you know, this is what it's all about. I'm going to talk to you about the tears in a second, if I may. Just going back to, I think you said measles vaccine 10 years or flu vaccine 10 years, or to develop vaccines, it can take years and years and years. Is that because constantly filling in forms and applying for funding and waiting for correspondence to come back and then you have to write again and go for funding? Because all of that seems to have been pushed to one side because this is a global emergency. Is a lot of that time taken up by applying for funding? And really, if we wanted to, we can get vaccines together pretty quickly when needs be.
So I think the what you're saying is right. You know, that before, the channels were just much more arduous, and you had to make the case for the need, and you had to make the case for the potential impact. The situation with COVID is the need was so patently obvious, and the risk to global health so transparent. You know, people have been, you know, the nobody needed to make that case. And I think at the last the briefing with that excellent briefing with Jonathan Van Tam, what they showed was not that these processes had been pushed to one side. I think we need to really be confident of the safety of these vaccines. It's just that they had really sat down and thought, how can we streamline these processes at the same time as maintaining quality assurance, safety checks? Remember, you know, I was on with you a month or a couple of months ago when the AstraZeneca trial was stopped.
That's right.
Momentarily, because of a safety issue. And it gives me real reassurance that despite all the pressures, the desperation to get an effective vaccine, those safety checks have still been maintained. And now what we've got is a much more streamlined way of monitoring and ensuring safety, and a much more, it seems to me, collaborative approach to sharing data and sharing information so that the world is benefiting much more quickly. And I think the other thing that I really, really like about this is that, say, for example, the AstraZeneca vaccine, they had the end in sight. This was a vaccine that was intentionally designed to reach the people of the world not just people who can afford expensive refrigeration and expensive logistics.
Exactly.
And that kind of real-world applied health thinking is really one of the victories for me in this.
Exactly. And supplied at cost always helps as well, doesn't it? And let's just move... We've got a couple of minutes left. Let's just move into this new tier system. We'll find out what the Health Secretary has to say about this. Our leaders here are quite... optimistic is the word to use, that we will end up in tier two. But we still need to be ultra careful. We still need to stick to those rules, because what we don't want is one step forward and three steps back. What are your thoughts on this tier system?
So I think I've said to you before, one of the virtues of having localised epidemiology, having localised data, is that you can have localised responses, and that helps us in balancing the harms of too restrictive a lockdown, you know, the social, the mental health, social economic, the economic harms of having too strict a lockdown, as opposed to the harms of having too lax a lockdown with COVID spread. So, you know, it only makes sense, really, to respond to the localised data. And I think last time I was on, I said how pleased I was that the role of the local public health experts, the local directors of public health, have been really elevated.
Well, it's like being a teacher, isn't it? You know your own kids. You know, that's probably a way to describe it. Angela, we can't let you go. You always give us a little bit of a lift with a couple of lines of a poem before we let you go. Have you got anything for this week? If you haven't, don't worry if I've caught you on the hop.
I do. So for me, this whole vaccine story has been a one world story. And the other reason why this next poem, it's a poem by a woman called Mary Oliver, and she's interested in the natural world. So this is called The Poem of the One World. And I liked it because I thought it features a heron. And up until this week, I thought the liver bird was based on a heron, but it's not. It's based on a cousin of the heron, which is a cormorant. And, you know, that spread-winged posture that we have in the liver body seems to represent the cormorants drying their wings because their feathers aren't waterproof, which I just learned that this week. But anyway, so this is a poem of the one world. So this morning, the beautiful white heron was floating along above the water, and then into the sky of this, the one world we all belong to, where everything, sooner or later, is a part of everything else, which thought made me feel, for a little while, quite beautiful myself.
Look at that. Perfect. Angela, thanks for your time once again, and hopefully we'll talk again in a week or so's time. We will have even some more good news. We'll certainly know where we are with the tier system as well. Good to talk to you. Thank you. There's Dr. Angela Obasi from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Right, let's get some travel news.